In case any of you had missed the announcement in lab lecture today, there is not going to be a quiz 3. There is going to be an exam 3. The question was asked, is it still going to be on the date scheduled? Which, remind me, that's scheduled for Friday of next week, correct? The date is currently unlikely to change. There is going to be some possible disruption to our class schedule this week or maybe next week, because there's some meetings that the chemistry, many of the members of the chemistry department will be part of. In fact, all of us are going to be finding substitutes for our classes, but there are only a limited number of substitutes, so it may end up that there might be class canceled. The most likely class that would get canceled, if it does, will be this Friday. And I'll try to make sure that I send a message out in plenty of time so you don't make any unnecessary trips into campus. We will have lab on Thursday. There is a small possibility, though, that we might not have lecture. So we may try to do what I was going to do in lecture in lab instead. However, if I'm more concerned about keeping all the sections synchronized, it is actually not the worst thing in the world if we miss that day on Thursday, because we're a full lecture and a half ahead of the other section. So the worst thing that will happen is we'd slow down and catch down to them? We can't catch up if we're slowing down, correct? English, what can you do? So, moving back to topic, or actual subject material now, I think we ended class on Friday talking about chromatography, didn't we? We were working on ion exchange chromatography of a mixture of amino acids in order to try to determine what the, not the order of amino acids is, but what types and how many of those particular amino acids we have in a protein chain. And I did also do a little bit of reading in some other texts. The term polypeptide and protein are interchangeable, but a protein tends to refer to a large, quote unquote, polypeptide. What does the word large mean? Well, it means large. So I couldn't find an actual number that's a supposed cutoff. I don't recall if your text mentions what qualifies truly as a protein. But let's say we had some form of protein that we were going to use this ion exchange column chromatography approach on. Why is it that in that approach we will be able to eventually figure out the identity? Ooh, if that's food, that either stays packed away or goes right back out. Gotta be slicker to sneak it in. What was I saying? Oh, why is it that that chromatography approach will give us the types of amino acids, but not the order that they're in? The long, uncomfortable silence is where those of you who have not read or studied need to go and see what is the first step in doing this column chromatography approach. You what? Ah, but what mixture? That is kind of the point. What is it a mixture of? Do we put a protein directly on this column? No. We first hydrolyze the protein. We cook it up in a strong acid source to force all the amide linkages to break. Remember that a polypeptide is a polymer that's made of an amide connected to an amide connected to an amide. So the preparation step is to break down all of those connections between the amino acids. So once you've done that, then you place that onto the column. But once you break apart the amino acids, there's no order retained whatsoever. It's just a whole bunch of individual amino acids. Bored today a little bit?
I'll have to spruce my lecture up, I guess.
So chromatography. Can be used to determine the number an amount of an amino acid in a protein. Group there. Chromatography can be used to determine the type and quantities of amino acids in a polypeptide, but cannot be used to determine order. Since to prepare for chromatography, a protein is first fully hydrolyzed. Now, just a refresher of what we got up to last time. We did talk about a column being just a tube that's filled with some kind of separation material. We have a sample that's loaded on the top, and then a solvent is pushed through. The interactions of different amino acids with the material in the column causes some of those amino acids to progress more slowly, and conversely, therefore, some are going to progress more quickly. Exactly which ones progress at which rate is going to be dependent on pH, because the pH is used to determine or establishes what proportion of cationic, neutral, or anionic amino acids we have. In theory, if we used more extreme pH values, we could also have a doubly charged, either double cation or double anion. If we had one of our amino acids that had two acid groups on it, like if we had an amino acid that had two acid groups on it, like aspartic acid, or if we had two amino groups on it, like lysine. The other amino acids we covered being proline, cysteine, serine, alanine, valine, leucine, and glycine. Oh, I left out phenylalanine. Again, just a little subtle hint that if your instructor's already done the work to memorize the amino acids, he's kind of expecting his students to do so as well. So, where we didn't finish is how are the results of this chromatography collected and then interpreted? Because as this stuff is coming off the column, I probably already mentioned that you can't use an anhydrin to identify an amino acid. Let's remind ourselves, though, what this anhydrin is. What is an anhydrin? Not the structure, but just where have we seen it used? Or how? It's a purple dye, or it makes things turn purple. So, just as a refresher again, an anhydrin is a triketone. That when it reacts with an amino acid, and it doesn't really matter the stereochemistry, and in a sense it doesn't, doesn't really matter the amino acid, because regardless of the amino acid, it's going to form the same complex. But notice that the R group does not end up part of this complex. Therefore, each amino acid makes the same derivative. Therefore, you can't use ninhydrin to identify an amino acid. It can be used to visualize amino acids. So, yes. You know you have an amino acid. You know where you have an amino acid. So the first place we saw this was in electrophoresis, where we had a paper across which we applied electric field. Depending on the pH that was used, the mix of amino acids will have different proportions of their cationic, anionic, and neutral forms. So because there's a different charge, you could say, on the different amino acids, they move different amounts or different directions, different distances, once you do put a charge across a piece of paper. But once they move, you can't see them. So we use the ninhydrin to then develop it, just the same way like a TLC. The TLC plate, we can prepare it, we can use it, we can do everything to it except see what's there until we do a visualization step. TLC, we can use UV light. For electrophoresis, we just spray it with ninhydrin. For column chromatography, we also use ninhydrin after the stuff comes off the column. So let's say that I had two different compounds. Compound one, and let's switch colors, call it compound two. Now, whether these are beakers or test tubes depends on real life how much of the protein you've decomposed and how much quantity-wise of total of the amino acids you have. But the idea is there's constantly solvent passing through this chromatography column. There's not always stuff coming off the column. Because once you put that amino acid soup on there, it does take time, even for the less binding of the amino acids, to make it through the column. So if you were to have a line of these test tubes or beakers, you would just scoot them one by one by one by one past this continuously flowing stream of liquid, or which in theory could have a valve on it if you needed to stop it. And so there might be nothing. In one beaker, you've got a little bit of the first amino acid. The next beaker, you have a lot of the amino acid. Next beaker, not very much again. Ideally, next beaker, there'd be nothing. And then eventually, an entirely different beaker, you would have the next compound that comes through. So, these different beakers or test tubes could be referred to as different fractions, different portions of the solvent that's coming out. So let me read out what I wrote here. Fractions are different proportions of the solvent eluting from the column that may contain one or more solutes. More would be bad because we're trying to separate these things out. But again, because amino acids have been studied rather well over the last 100 years or whatever, we have protocols developed that can be used to successfully separate out these different amino acids. To tell you even have the amino acid in a fraction, you could use an anhydrin. But we can use an anhydrin not just as a crude qualitative test, we could also use it quantitatively. So this is a throwback to Chem 1B, but there is this popularly named Beer's Law, which does anybody happen to have good 1B recall or heard the that I was going to talk about Beer's Law and remembers the equation? It's what? Okay, or instead of doing transmittance, we talk about absorbance, which is related to transmittance. Okay, what is absorbance proportional to? Three things. Something to do with just the material itself, which is that's a fudge factor known as the extinction coefficient. There is the concentration of the solution. The more stuff in it, the darker it should be. And then there's the path length that light itself passes through. The more of a material you pass through, again, the more light's absorbed, so the darker color appears to be. So once we have one of these solutions that we've collected off of column, then we could measure the volume of that solution. Ninhydrin's complex, this room in purple, very well studied as well. You could get the absorbance of that purple solution. You would know the path length that you're using. You'd know it's ninhydrin's complex, so you'd know what the extinction coefficient is. Measure the absorbance, you can therefore calculate the concentration. You know the concentration and the volume, you know moles, you figure it out for all the amino acids present, and from that you could get the mole fraction, or however you wanted to present that, the easiest way, mole fraction of each amino acid in the entire polypeptide chain. So one last time, this method separates out amino acids, but does not retain any order information because you separate all of the amino acids before you do this technique. This technique depends, the way I described it, on charge interaction. I think this is the section that asked about whether size can have an influence. And the answer there is such a thing as size exclusion chromatography, but size is not the main factor here. Polarity is what we learned separating things out when we did TLC. There are polarity effects. You could even do a column that separates more on polarity. But because so many of these amino acids are going to be charged, that's why the ion exchange material is used, because it can even more fully resolve or separate the amino acids from each other. Once the amino acids come off of this column, the identity of an amino acid is determined by its retention time, which I wrote that down before, but since we've been focusing on the after, I'll just put in as a reminder. In chromatography, the identity of an amino acid is determined by retention time. But aside from that, we can use these solutions to determine how much of the acid is, which that's the discussion of Beer's Law, using a spectroscopic observation to be able to come up with a concentration of the solution, which, again, given the volume solution, lets you get moles, which lets you get mole fraction. So questions about the lecture from last time, which had the more full discussion of PI, of electrophoresis, and the first part of this chromatography, or anything from today's lecture. Then what about a true sequencing? Well, there's one form of sequencing that is shown in many organic texts. Some organic texts that have a more biological bent will have a few more of these. I'll double check and see what your text speaks to see which ones of these that you'll need to know. But I know for sure that you'll need to know one of these types of reagents. And the specific reagent I want to show us is one used in what's called the Edman degradation. Which allows individual amino acids to be cleaved from a polypeptide chain in order, which allows the sequence of a polypeptide to be determined. The reagent is phenyl isothiocyanate. Now you might remember thiocyanates are not thio, isocyanates from our amine chapter where we had the Curtius and Hoffman rearrangements. These rearrangements I keep reminding us that we haven't had any questions on yet. So phenyl isothiocyanate means a sulfur analog. And this will have a very, very, very interesting reaction with amino acid chains, with a very, very, very interesting mechanism. Which I've realized I never did send you out the Edmund handout, so I'll make sure I do that once I post the notes today. It is probably not a mechanism I'm going to have you memorize, or at least not a mechanism I'm going to have you write step by step down, because it's, I forgot how many it is, but it's at least 8 cycles of protein open attacking protein, protein open attacking protein, and rings forming and rings opening and rings closing and yeah. But we're going to talk about the highlights of that mechanism, and at least at first, I'm going to try to do it without looking, because again, this is, this sugars I've got down under my own brain now. Got those under control, but somehow every year I struggle with amino acids. So this year I'm trying to really make myself memorize this so that I'll do better for you all, but even better for the next class around. So, if we have an amino acid chain, what's it going to look like? Well, it's going to have an amino end, of course. I'm not going to show stereochemistry, going to make this needlessly complicated beyond what it is. And so then I'll just show that we have this carboxylic acid group. Now, given the phenylisothiocyanate, and that, and that's not OH, because we're supposed to be talking about the chain. That's the whole point here. Which, by the way, someone pointed out in the office hours that, I don't know if it was their own notes, but I'm guessing it was my actual notes. I wrote a poly or tripeptide out in a hurry one day and had an oxygen linking two amino acids together instead of a nitrogen. So if you ever discover in the notes any of these chains, polypeptide chains, where I have an ether link or ester linkage instead of amide, change that to nitrogen. Okay, so now we have this. What's probably the only logical reaction that's going to happen between this, even if it did have the carboxylic acid chain further down, and the phenylisothiocyanate? Well, isocyanates. What did we previously react them with? With water, right? Or hydroxide? And what kind of product was created from that? I just blanked on the name. Carbamic acid, which decarboxylates, which is why these methods end up causing a loss of carbon in order to get an amine. The point here is that the carbon in the middle is still going to act like a carbonyl carbon or an imine carbon. Realize that these isocyanates are like a carbonyl, a ketone, and an imine stuck together. So the carbon's going to get attacked, which is the same thing that's going to happen with the phenylisothiocyanate. So first step is to make something that looks like this. So the important point here is we first make what's called a thiourea. So urea is carbonyl with a nitrogen on either end, so it's kind of like a double amide, you could say. Thiourea just means substitute a sulfur instead. Now, this is where things start to get complicated. So, imagine this. We have this nitrogen with a lone pair on it, which we know is heavily going to conjugate with a carbonyl, if we had a carbonyl. Well, carbon-sulfur double bond has very similar reactivity. So you could imagine that that nitrogen's got some pretty heavy interactions with the sulfur. Of course, we have this carbonyl next door as well, and that is an amide bond. Well, if we have the right kind of conditions where we could have some protonate open tachyprotonate, protonate open tachyprotonate, wouldn't it theoretically be possible that we could try to tautomerize, where the nitrogen would make a double bond with carbon, pushing the carbon-sulfur bond open? Well, there is this carbonyl right across the way here that the sulfur might be able to attack, which if it did so, would end up pushing open this other carbonyl.
There's one small facet of this transformation I just want to make sure I have right, which is whether the carbonyl closes up again right away or not. So let me look before I leap. Ah, your book shows it as separate steps, so I will do the same thing. So this is not exactly a proper mechanism. More, I'm going to be showing you what happens. So again, nitrogen could try to push open that carbon-sulfur bond, which then can reach out and attack the carbonyl across the way, and then push that carbonyl open. So now we formed a ring, and if you look, we have one carbon in which we have a sulfur, a nitrogen, and an oxygen all attached. That's going to be a really reactive intermediate, and it's kind of like if we were halfway through doing a esterification or de-esterification. So imagine that the carbonyl reforms. And instead of kicking the sulfur back open, what if it kicked the chain out? Then we end up with the following. We end up with a five-membered ring that is effectively a thioester. There's a specific name for this, which I actually remembered this even before reading the chapter, which must be from my undergrad days from way long time ago, so you need to know this type of derivative as well. This is a thiazolanone, which the zol ending has to do with one of these five-membered nitrogen-containing rings. The own part refers to the fact that that ring also is part of a ketone. Thia is a prefix meaning the ring itself contains sulfur. So thiazolanone means five-membered ring with a nitrogen in it that also happens to have a carbonyl and a sulfur. How about the benzene ring? It's just a derivative of a thiazolanone.
Didn't put the specific name for this compound because all you need to know is that it describes this functional group. But notice something really super important. That the rest of that polypeptide chain is kicked out during this mechanism. I started this whole thing out by saying there's going to be this technique where we can pull one amino acid off at a time. This is it, because as this process occurs, which again, it's kind of like we're swapping out an amide for a thioester, if you look at it. That's why it's a whole bunch of protein. As that happens, the rest of the peptide chain is kicked out, which means we're dealing with just one R group. Since this reaction, until you put another phenyl isothiocyanate in it, doesn't do anything else to the peptide chain, that means after we get this one compound out of solution, then we could chew off the next amino acid and identify it, and then the next one and identify it. That's how this Edman degradation is useful. We're not quite finished because it turns out the thiazolinones are not isolatable. They form as an intermediate, but then it decomposes. Because, let's see if I can remember what happens next. Because, yes, we exchanged an amide for a thioester, but we know that amides are less reactive than esters. So what if this compound opens again to try to form an amide? Now let me make this comment about the rest of the peptide chain disappearing. At this point of the mechanism, the remainder of the polypeptide is ejected from the phenyl isothiocyanate derivative. Phenyl isothiocyanate. The phenyl isothiocyanate derivative itself can be used to identify the amino acid that had been pulled off the chain. And effectively what happens is this. So the thiazolinone we had up above can do a ring opening. This is the one part I need to look at my own handout to figure out, because your book doesn't have it.
Oh, of course. Well, it forms something along the lines of this. The ring opens back up again, and now effectively an amide is made again. Oops, I forgot my R group. Go. And where this name comes from, I'm not sure, but it is called a phenylhydantoin. Main point of all of this is that this thing that can be isolated, and because each derivative is unique depending on which R group ends up on it, you can identify the amino acid. So, started this off with the Edmond reagent, part of the Edmond degradation, reminded us of this isocyanate that has the same first type of step where you produce a carboxylic acid derivative by reacting with this, in this case, isothiocyanate. There's a series of conversions between different carboxylic acid derivatives, which involves some ring openings and closings. The thiazolidone is an intermediate formed. It just happens to further decompose in solution to make one of these hydantoins. It's one of those hydantoins that can be isolated. And because each one is different depending on the R group that was removed, that's how you can identify an amino acid. Back up to above, since one amino acid is removed at a time, that means we can sequence an amino acid chain, starting from the amino end going towards the carbon terminus. Questions about the Edmond degradation? Yeah. Apparently, if I remember correctly, it's the isolation that causes the decomposition from the thiazolinone to the product. The first portion of that doesn't involve water. I think it's once water comes in that we have the subsequent degradation. So if you kept things in hydrous while you were doing the first part of the reaction and made sure that you did an order of addition correctly, then you would be able to start that process. Ooh, how does that happen? I'm going to have to read up. I'm sure it's an order of addition trick. And a reaction conditions trick. There must be some side reaction possible because this only works a certain number of times, although from when I started teaching here, the books seem to keep increasing the numbers as far as how many times this truly is successful. And then there are more modern methods, which I know shockingly little about other than their acronyms, things like PCR. But that's for another class. Other questions about this degradation? So what have we done with amino acids? We've talked about some of the different families of amino acids. We talked about stereochemistry. We talked about the fact that they make these polypeptide chains. We saw how could we make a polypeptide chain.
How can we break it back apart again to figure out what kinds and how many of different amino acids there are? And now we've seen how to figure out the sequence of amino acids, at least an older method to do so. Now, it might be useful if we step back and talk about synthesizing amino acids. You know, what if we want to go in the lab and make some new kind of creature using some new kind of amino acid? How could that be done? So we won't have much time today, so we'll only get through one of these techniques, but that's what we will pick up on one way or another on Thursday. On Thursday, we'll also talk about protein structure. So just so that this lecture is not any more dry and boring than what I make it, because I'm almost the only one that talks, if you would read up, it would help the question answer bit of this work a little more smoothly. So, synthesis of amino acids. Let me just review. This might be useful to direct your reading. Let me review the ones that your particular text has. Section number? Okay, everything I'm doing is in chapter 23. The section number for the phenylisothiocyanate is, where is it? Section 23.13. And then synthesis of different amino acids. Oh, wow. Strikingly short in this text. Okay. It's in 23.6. The one I'll start with, just because it's something that you might recognize, it's a variation of the malonic ester synthesis called the thalamidyl malonic ester synthesis. So imagine we started out with diethylmalonate. But not diethylmalonate. What if we had alpha-bromo-diethylmalonate? Is elimination in this molecule possible? Elimination meaning all the way back to Chem-12A. E2-style elimination. Is that possible? I don't know the true, honest answer. But it wouldn't be terribly likely, or at least you wouldn't get the product you think you would, because you'd be trying to make the equivalent of an enol. Is SN2 impossible in this molecule? No, because it's just a secondary substrate. So it may react more slowly than a primary, but it still react. Now, we've seen previously the thalamide being used in the Gabriel synthesis where we could deprotonate this nitrogen. I already show it pre-deprotonated. To then alkylate it to make a customized primary amine. Well, what if I put these two different substrates together?
Then this SN2 reaction I'm referring to could occur. So this is N-thalamido malonic ester. So I should say diethyl N-thalamido malonic ester. That still has an alpha proton on it.
And so you could use a base. Ethoxide would be a logical choice if we have an ethyl ester to deprotonate. And then just so I don't have to write this whole thing over and over again, let's say we now had a primary alkyl halide. We could substitute. And then if we hydrolyze, remember from the Gabriel synthesis that once we hydrolyze this thalamide, we release a primary amine from it. Remember that when the malonic ester gets hydrolyzed, we make malonic acid, which with just a little heat and acid will decarboxylate. And so what you'll end up with is an amino acid. The only drawback of this particular approach is, as you can see, I didn't make one particular amino acid or another. I would end up making it an enantiomeric mix. But there are ways to separate out enantiomers, and I'll bring that into our discussion on Thursday. So Thursday, definitely lab, possibly lecture in lab. Thursday lecture itself, depending on whether I have a sub and if our schedule stays the same, might be canceled. Friday might be canceled. We'll let you know enough ahead of time, like I said, that you don't make a needless trip in.